you will have noticed that the way of yoga is broadly presented as an eightfold way. Morality, the religious observances, posture, the breath control, then pratyahara as the freedom of sense activity from attachment and aversion, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. We must not think of this as the exact correspondent, it isn't, of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. It happens that these two classifications are eightfold classifications. There are other classifications too, and even the same teacher's teaching can be presented according to different classifications. For instance, the Buddhist may be presented in a threefold form as the Silas, the practice of morality, Samadhi, the meditation, and Panya, wisdom, meaning insight into the truth of things. So you get a threefold classification there for the Buddhist. Similarly, in Christian mysticism, where the actual procedure is very much like that in Hindu or Buddhist teachings, you can have a threefold classification as purgation, illumination, and union, that is, the Unio Mystica. Or you can have it as a fivefold presentation. First, the awakening or conversion. It's very interesting the way they put it. The awakening or conversion. The turning away from worldliness, which of course is one of the fundamental meanings of becoming a yogi. This turning away from the worldly awareness of existence to the religious awareness of existence. So the whole world, our entire life, is seen in a different way. You will remember yesterday I mentioned the two paths, as they are called in Hindu presentation, the pravritti, the going forth outwards into the world, getting immersed in worldliness, and the nirvritti path, the turning away from the world, from worldliness, the path of return, the path of restoration to the primal wholeness. You see, the religious turning away from the worldly to the religious. So you have the same idea in this first step in the fivefold presentation in Christian mysticism. Then you have self-knowledge or purgation. It's very interesting that self-knowledge is here is not an intellectual analysis of oneself as such. or shall I say an exclusively intellectual analysis and observation. The self-knowledge or purgation, meaning that the process of purification itself brings self-knowledge. Well, obviously, that must be the case. Because if you don't see that this needs purifying, well, you carry on gaily with all the stains, as one may call them, still clinging to you. You see? That's the second. And that, of course, corresponds to the Buddhist silas, the practice of the moralities. Then the third stage is illumination. One begins to see the truth of things. One really begins to understand the implications, the responsibilities of living the religious life. What it means in thought and feeling, in word, in action, and above all, in the state of awareness. Are we living in terms of self-awareness or in terms of God-awareness? Then comes the stage of the surrender or the dark night of the soul. Now, all of us experience again and again, in greater or lesser measure, something corresponding to this dark night of the soul. But this dark night of the soul, in its final state, its final attack upon you, so to say, is one of the most terrible experiences to go through. There are the words of Jesus, for instance, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? I know that some give this translation, how thou dost glorify me. But this dark night of the soul is something like a state of the stupefaction of the mind. Suddenly everything disappears. There is nothing to hold on to. We have to bear in mind that in the mysticisms, whether it be Christian or any other mysticism, there is always the affirmation of the ultimate reality in these terms, as God, the anchor to which to hold on to. And the whole life of the mystic has been geared to this. The mystic has set his sights upon God. And that transcendent mind energy in himself, which is stimulated by so doing, suddenly ceases to hold him, uphold him, and it's gone. And then comes the utter darkness, the terrible doubt, the struggle of the intellect and the emotions and everything to bring back this God of the mystic's conception. And here he realizes the dissolution of this final conception. Because in the process of purgation and so on, he lets go of all conceptions, knowing that they come, they go, that they are not the reality, they are not the reality. But the arbitrarily affirmed reality by the mind and the heart of the mystic, which is God, that too suddenly becomes eclipsed. Completely eclipsed. And it's a state of distress which is beyond description. One can only speak symbolically. It's as if the whole being is completely chilled, frozen, petrified. How to emerge again out of that state of petrification is one of the great problems of the mystic life. Because no one else now can do anything for him. If we look at it, or try to look at it, a little more clearly in actual terms, what has happened is that having come to the end of the way to realization in terms of the known, of the accepted, the understood, something which can still be seen as a particular shape and form, having come to the end of all that, the flight into the uncharted abyss has to take place. There are no wings to fly with. What is there to assure the mystic that the whole thing has not been a mighty illusion from beginning to end? And this is an extraordinary fear, a transcendent fear, so to say, transcendental fear, which comes upon the soul. See, get petrified with fear. What is this? The sense of annihilation overwhelms him. Because whether we accept the theistic view or the non-theistic view, we do not accept the idea of annihilation. One way or another, the affirmation of life as an eternal reality is present with us. And it is this affirmation which crumbles down. How is he to step into this unknown? And this is what he has to come through, all by himself. And one of the great things to discover is that the coming through happens naturally. You just be quiet and allow it to happen. You don't attempt to bring it about. And it is very difficult to apply this in practice, in that state of the dark night of the soul. It's altogether overwhelming. But then comes the surrender. It is the when you have ceased to make the effort, when you have really freed yourself from yourself, you have become absent to yourself, then you let go altogether. And in that letting go, the old spiritual drive and impulse, which was surrender to God as you tread the path, gives place to surrender to God in reality and not God in definition. It's a very different thing. When that happens, the transcendent unknown has taken you right into itself, and you are unresisting then, absolutely unresisting. And then the fear goes. The fear is absent forever after that. And this surrender takes place, which has no association with our ordinary experience of surrender, meaning that we are defeated and therefore we surrender. This is not the surrender of defeat. This is not the surrender of victory. Because defeat and victory are a duality. And they exist only insofar as awareness itself suffers from the limitations of duality. And that limitation is rarely gone. But the word surrender is used because you have ceased to struggle. And in actual fact, therefore, it's neither surrender nor victory. It is this complete merging, this at-one-ment, the atonement with the ultimate reality. And after that, there is the complete union, the union which never ends, the timeless union, not the union which comes, which goes. You know how the Buddha, for instance, says, when he's talking to Aggivesana, who was a Jain, and he came and conversed with the Buddha, and he must have been a very developed and a remarkable sort of person, considering what the Buddha says to him. And one of the things the Buddha says is, he makes the admission that he is in the shunyata phala samadhi, in which he abides constantly. The shunyata phala, phala is fruit, shunyata of emptiness, the void, samadhi, communion. Or if you like to use the old phrase, concentration. I don't like the word concentration, it has its difficulties. The shunyata phala samadhi, in which I constantly abide. So now this Shunyata Phala Samadhi is possibly the Buddhist correspondent of this union of the Christian mystic, the permanent union. Now bear in mind something. We, as we are, fluctuate between the conscious and the unconscious. In actuality, there is only one whole. It is convenient for us to talk about it in terms of the conscious and the unconscious state. I'm not referring entirely to the unconscious as used by psychologists in the ordinary sense, because with the purification and all the rest of it, you have gone far past all that separation of the conscious and the unconscious. The unconscious is largely a big cesspool, in fact, full of trivial nonsense and a certain amount of dirt. And you have really gone past that. But I'm referring to the unconscious, shall I say, at a much higher octave. This transcendent mind energy which functions through the universe without our knowing it. We don't know it, we cannot see it as we are. It's only when one releases the inner powers of the mind to be sensitive to this that you begin to touch it as such. Now, when one experiences, I'm still talking in the Christian mystical terms now, when one experiences the sense of union with God, it comes, it goes. There is no permanency about it. Permanency in time. And when it comes, it pervades the whole conscious self, which is uplifted. You are in that state which the mystics have called ecstasy. Sometimes it is ecstasy, but far profounder and deeper than that is the state of the enstasy. In ecstasy, you're outside yourself, you're beside yourself sometimes. Not in an unpleasant sense, because that would mean madness, but you are beside yourself, outside yourself. And then you sort of come back to the normal enclosed state. But in ecstasy, you have entered right within yourself, not exclusively. Because the self is now no longer just this thing enclosed within the skin. A skin bag full of stuff. It's no longer that. There is a free flowing outwards. But the sense of being outside yourself and therefore still preserving a duality is not there. Now, in this union, once and for all, there are no walls, no barriers between the conscious and the unconscious in the transcendent sense. This is the ultimate state of union. This, I feel quite strongly, is one of the meanings of the Shunyata Phala Samadhi. It's an extraordinary thing. You see, we as we are reading the books and so on have can't sort of have the vaguest vision. Concept is not a good word in this concept, in this context. We haven't the vaguest vision of the implications of all these deep jhanas and so forth. You have to have personal realization in some form or other, in some degree or other. And if it happens that your own brain, your own intellect is of that nature, if you are, as the Hindus would put it, if you are of the jnana yogi type, the wisdom yogi type, then the brain will formulate it less misleadingly than any other formulation of this kind of experiencing. So now, when this union is attained, it is not a case of knowing constantly in your ordinary sense-mind consciousness of that transcendence which, with which you are in perpetual union. You are in the union where the unified state is perfectly natural to you, but of which you are not directly conscious in sense-mind terms. Just as if the body is perfectly healthy and active and so forth, it does everything naturally, you take it in your stride, you are not conscious of your health. You see? It's there with you all the time. In that sense, there is this union of the mystic. The state of union, the unio mystica, becomes a permanency. And it culminates in what all types of mystics have called deification, the becoming God. Now, in the history of Christendom, this has been a source of difficulty and trouble. And yet there have been some Christian mystics who have very clearly indicated, without fear of consequences from the Catholic Church, have very clearly indicated that this is the fact. There is the divinization of the person. Christendom attributes divinity only to Jesus Christ, exclusively. And no one else may claim that. That is the orthodox approach. But the mystics have clearly indicated it. St. Bernard was one. Ruysbroeck was another. There was a third. Eckhart gave it a very interesting form. He said outright, God verily is man. Man verily is God. He made the statement in both ways, peculiarly after the Buddhist fashion. No. This deification, Julian of Norwich? I don't know about that. But these two particularly have been quite specific about it. And Dionysius the Areopagite certainly gave out a tremendous amount along these lines. Maybe. Right. Now, with that state of deification, one lives the unitive life, as it is called. The everyday life, getting up in the morning, washing, cooking, breakfast, etc., etc., going about your daily business, but as the deified one, the unitive life. Well, what is the difference, you'd say then, between that person's activities and the ordinary person's activities? The activities are the same in everyday life. But let us ask the question, in which way can they be different? Do we expect some magical performances to go on all the time? Not a bit of it. The difference is just this. I, the ordinary man of the world, in what way am I aware of my life from moment to moment? I, the deified one, in what way am I aware of this same life and its external observances from moment to moment? The transformation is the transformation in the mode of awareness of existence. This sentence sums up all the progress, as we call it, the fulfillment, the development, the culmination between the worldly state and the realized state. It's a transformation of the mode in which one is aware of existence. In the worldly state, I'm all the time trying to draw the world into me, for my sake. In the unworldly state, in the deified state, the nirvanic state, if you like, there is no grasping at anything for me. There is no deliberate, thought-out living for others. All dualities are gone. They are really gone. Then one sees every person who, in the ordinary way, for linguistic convenience, we call the other person, we see every other person as another version of oneself, and oneself as another version of every other person. The full consciousness of humanity as one humanity, in fact, of the totality of existence as one totality, functions freely through you. You see the implications of this. In the quality of life which is lived then, through the ordinary everyday actions, there is complete harmlessness. There is complete truthfulness, honesty. Complete love and wisdom are there. And there is beauty in that life. The beauty which does not need the onlooker to see and recognize it. Who was the poet who wrote, "Many a flower is born to blush unseen"? Wordsworth. There we are. The flower, pouring forth its beauty, making no attempt to pour it forth, because it is the beauty and the perfection and the wonder of the total reality. That is all. you have come to the state of the uttermost simplicity. A state in which you absorb everything that happens without reacting against what is wrong, what is evil, but understanding it, absorbing it, and in that understanding and absorbing, it becomes transformed. Not appraising what is good and holding it to your heart to the exclusion of what is called the not good. You know, this transformed consciousness is a most extraordinary thing. One can never begin to describe it. It is the totally different. And it is because of the realization of such things by human beings that the theologies of the world conceptually have presented God as the wholly other than this. Of course, conceptual presentation has its difficulties and has given rise to endless trouble because it has put God outside. But what they were trying to do was to suggest, I believe, that when this transformation has taken place, the godly state, the all-enlightened state, is something which is utterly beyond anything that we know and experience here. And therefore, it is called the wholly other than this. And then you personalize it and say, God, the personal being, is wholly other. Now, you stepped into the mire of conflict because of that particular description. That is all. So there you get the Christian mystical presentation as a fivefold presentation, not only a threefold. You have a sevenfold presentation of the way in the Sufi journey through the seven valleys, as it is called. It comes in Attar's poem, The Colloquy of the Birds. Namely, the valleys of the quest, love, knowledge, detachment, unity, amazement, and total unselfing. See where we all end up. This total unselfing, this fundamental duality, I and the not I, that is no more. Now, in this presentation, it is very interesting to note and savor the order in which it is presented. The quest, the search, then comes love, then comes knowledge. We have the saying, haven't we, love maketh wise. Then comes detachment. Now this detachment, this dispassion, which the Buddha emphasizes so very strongly in all his discourses, is the state of freedom from attachment and aversion, both. One has gone right beyond all greed and violence. So there is detachment. This detachment is not being separate from anything or everything. Do you remember that? This detachment is a state of freedom which emerges because we know, we really know that we are in everything, everything is in us. What then shall I grasp at? It is me. To give an absurd analogy, my nose is on my face. I don't need to grasp it to keep it there. It's there. It is part of me. But what is beyond my nose, out in my state of ignorance, I say is not me. You see, this is pure yoga too. The yogi who declares finally, Aham Brahmasmi. Now you see, there is no conceit in that at all. It's a plain statement of fact. I am Brahman, the totality, the absolute all. That is what I really am. But I am ignorant of that fact. Because my awareness, because consciousness is restricted, circumscribed within this body. And so there is the association of self with the body. The Sarvasara Upanishad. I don't suppose any of you have even heard the name of it. The Sarvasara Upanishad says outright that bondage lies in identifying the ultimate real, in this case it is named the Atma, with the body only. This is the illusion. The Atma is the totality. Whether we regard it as the manifest totality, the material as we call it, or the mental or the spiritual, these are all terms which merely differentiate our different modes of awareness of what is. So there is detachment. And in that state of detachment, obviously, that next step, unity, must of necessity be there. When I really am aware that you are me, I am you. We are just different versions of each other. Then there is the realization of unity. And this realization of unity is the culmination of love and knowledge together, which come earlier on. Then there is amazement. I think it is the Sufis alone who have presented this aspect. I haven't come across it. Has any of you come across it in any other religious or mystical system? Amazement. This beautiful wonder, this beautiful sense of wonder, this perpetual wonder. And you see, this sense of wonder is the thing that makes for the complete joy of life, the real zest of life. We are in maturity as children. That's the marvel of it. We have regained the pristine purity of childhood. of such is the kingdom of heaven. Amazement. Was it not William Blake, who was one of those mystic poets, who was very much alive to this sense of wonder all the time, this amazement? You know, I often see little children, very little ones, as I'm walking the street or whatever it is. And when I look at them, and just the ghost of a smile comes into my eyes, and they look just like that, you know, their whole being seems to go out to you in response. It's extraordinary. I remember on one occasion, a very mundane occasion, a worldly occasion, I was going to the bank. And there was a little fellow, tiny little tot, in the pram, howling away. And I just peered a little bit into his face, this little smile, and he stopped. I presume it was a he, I don't know whether it was a he or a she. And started, you know, giggling. It is this wonderful energy which is amazement, which comes through when that happens. And it comes, look at the position in which it is placed. The quest, love, knowledge, detachment, unity, amazement. When there is the unity with the divine, there is this amazement. Can't you picture God saying to the mystic, yes, I am God. Look at me. And then the seventh, the total unselfing, which is the real fruiting. Absolute fruition. The non-obstruction to transcendence. And then, that is the sevenfold classification and presentation. And we have the eightfold one, as in the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, or in the eight-limbed yoga. It's called the eight-limbed, Anga is the word used. And Atharvan, the great teacher, gives his teaching to Shandilya in these terms. You see, the Upanishads are the origin of the later systematized yoga. But the original teachings all come in the Upanishads. That is why the Upanishads are so very important and fundamental. Well, we'll stop there now and continue after coffee. I think we are beginning to understand the meaning of the basic unity of religion and religious teachings. The unity lies not in formulated doctrines so much as in the living roots from which these doctrines emanate. Consider for a moment or two the Zarathustrian threefold presentation. It is put very simply as good thought, good word, good deed. Now we all, quite naturally and not wrongly, immediately think of it in our terms, at our level. The word good is used in its obvious moralistic connotation. This is good as opposed to, different from, that which is bad. Good thought, good word, good deed. But all these teachings have their profounder level, their inner depth, in which one has gone beyond the dualities. One is dealing with the actual energies at play in the process of our life and development. The word thought has a meaning quite different from our ordinary meaning of the word thought. For us, thought is just a string of words which makes a superficial impress upon the mind. It is a means of communicating an impress which we have to another person. For that, of course, thought uses the medium, the instrument of the spoken word or the written word. But what is thought in its deep sense? You look at the root of the word in Sanskrit. Manyate is to think or to mind. Its root is man. But the process of minding, in the profound, the transcendent sense, is identical with creation. That which is minded is another way of saying created. If you and I could release the inner depths of mind into full activity, they are in a dormant state at present. It becomes a creative power in immediate action. You see the hint of this in scriptures which say, and God created this, that, and the other, just like that. By the power of the word, and God said so and so, and so and so was. Instead of the word said, supposing we use the word minded. So you see, this minding is an activity of energy which is not constricted in the shell of language, of words. Words are a symbol, are symbols. It is only if and when words become identical with mind power, in this profound sense, creative power, that the word is the creative word. It's a very interesting point. Those who are masters of the Kabbalah claim, and it is a belief common to the Hebrews, that the words of the Hebrew language themselves are a creative power. They are not mere words that you or I could speak, that they have creative power. And those words, they say, brought forth that which we experience and what is in existence and so forth. Now, in India, especially the philosophers of the Nyaya and Vaisheshika philosophies, roughly around the 4th century BC, put forth this doctrine of Sphota, the power of the word, the Sphotayana doctrine, as it is called. And Sphota means the real essence of the word, which is not merely the external sound, but a sound essence which is a creative energy. And they declared that the original Veda was composed of words of this sort. And since we associate the idea of God with creation, we always talk of God the Creator first and foremost. That is the normal, that's the usual way. God is love, or anything else comes afterwards. God is the maker of everything, as we say, or the creator of everything. This creative power is involved in it. And the Hindus claim that the original Veda, that the author of the original Veda is Brahma himself. Just as God is the author of the original Kabbalah, the Hebrew words. It's an interesting point. Now, these words uttered, or if you like, this process of minding, of thinking, is creative power in action. This is the way they put it. Now, what is the good thought in this sense, in this transcendent sense? If you and I can think in this manner, we would produce physical phenomena. Of course, especially to the modern world, this is rather absurd. They say, well, what's all this stupid reversal to superstitious beliefs and magic and whatnot? But it may be that the modern scientific world will enter the field of magic and then find that it is very natural. Nothing superstitious. The word magic has got a suspect flavor to it, hasn't it? But that will disappear in time with knowledge. So the good thought of Zarathustra, the good word, and the good action, vahu mano, is good mind, good thought. This trinity of the good thought, good word, good deed is a triple expression of the one absolute good, the good power, this creative power. It's a triple action because it all takes place simultaneously in the timeless. Creation takes place timelessly. It is the emergence of form, pattern, and then all that our senses convey to us, which follows afterwards, and the consciousness of time is introduced into our life, into our mode of awareness of the life process. Take the Buddha's statement in the Dhammapada. Cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind. That is the way of the Buddhas. Where does that lead to? The disappearance of evil, the full emergence of what is good, the mind which is utterly void of all particular thought forms and is enlightened, is transparent. But to what? This primordial creative energy. And what has happened to the evil which has ceased? The Buddha said there is no such thing as annihilation. Therefore, this evil has undergone the transformation into the absolute good. Which should make us seek and understand clearly that evil is not a thing in itself apart from you or me, nor is what we call good apart from you or me. This projecting of good and evil out of our own state of consciousness is one of the unfortunate things that we in our state of ignorance do, and introduce the state of psychical conflict between good and evil. Because out of my state of ignorance, I am aware in this manner, I am conscious in this manner, that consciousness is immediately reflected in what we call thought, feeling, word, speech, and physical action. If that consciousness has pressed out of itself something which is denominated evil, then all the suffering part comes into being. The suffering consequent upon evil, inevitably associated with evil, comes into being. But if the transformation of consciousness has taken place, because the ignorance has given place to clear seeing, the enlightened state, then that consciousness will always press out of itself only that which is denominated the good. Now you see, the original Veda and the original Kabbalah and so forth taught a great deal about the display of energies of in terms of consciousness itself. The play of energies. Now there is a difficulty involved in attempting to study that in the state in which we are. Because studying that means you're studying power. Play of energy is power. And am I fit to handle power? Would you ask a person who has absolutely no knowledge of cars and how to drive them to drive your car? It's asking for a crash, isn't it? One must have the necessary knowledge, the necessary skill to handle power. And that skill and knowledge are always absent or are too partial until at our level of duality and multiplicity, what we call the virtues, the moralities, call them what you will, have come to fruition. At the same time, we must also remember, this is our dilemma, that all through the day, whatsoever we think, feel, do, say, is a handling of energies. If you cook a meal, you're handling energy. This is power in action. Cook the meal badly and see what happens around. That is a mishandling of the energies. So we can't say, oh, I'll wait till I've developed all the moralities, then I will do this, then I will do that. This is where we make a great mistake, and we can't avoid it because of our conditioning and our state of ignorance. This is the rungs of the ladder conception of life and of coming to fruition. It is not a case of so many rungs on the ladder. It's not a case of first years go into this class, second years into that class, and so forth. It's not that sort of thing. This is a living process, and it takes place simultaneously. Now, the difficulty is this. In a general way, we know all this. But we become unmindful, we are forgetful. careful when engaged in any particular activity of the other aspects which bear upon this activity. We forget our moralities when we want pleasure, when we are driven by our natural urges, when our ambitions are aroused, when we are seduced by advertisements and this, that and the other. See, we forget our moralities altogether. We are unmindful. Now, in the religious life, in the living of the holy life, as presented in all the religions, this business of being mindful holds the central place. And of necessity, it must hold the central place, because only you and I, this remarkable animal species known as man, can exercise mindfulness in the way we understand mindfulness and what it means. This power of being observant immediately, in terms of retrospection, as well as in terms of foresight as to the way the present is likely to emerge. In all these ways, we can be mindful as no animal can be. So, this factor of mindfulness is really the linchpin of the whole story. It hangs upon that. And this mindfulness is an extremely difficult thing. Very difficult indeed. Mindfulness grows with gathered experience only if we are mindful of the gathering of experience. Which means this: if we are mindful of the gathering of experience, we will save ourselves from interpreting moment-to-moment experience according to our conditioning, according to the drive of desire, according to our likes and dislikes, our attachments and aversions. This is our specific task in the whole process. Be mindful this way, and the unity of good thought, good word, good deed at our level, our ordinary worldly level, will become a reality. Otherwise, it will remain in the state of conflict. Oh, that is a bad thought. Come on, clear out. And you have a fight with it. Oh, this is an unwise course of action. Therefore, I must change it into a wise course of action, and so forth. All these things come into play. The living of the simple moralities, then, is obviously no light task. It is extremely difficult. If we were to look at people in the world, we will see how easily they believe. Look at ourselves. We are in the world. How easily we believe we are such nice people. We take it for granted that we are right and good. This is partly due to the fact that we are definitely ignorant of the fact that this is not right or not good. It is a mistake in sincerity. It's an honest mistake. We don't know about it. But if we do not sit back on our haunches and take it for granted that everything's all right, but just keep an open mind about it and look at it and say, well, I'll see whither this leads, what happens. If you keep alert, as I said yesterday, then ignorance will get steadily dispelled, like the sun dispels the morning mist. Now, we may take a list of qualities, good qualities as we call them. This is what we have to develop. Or we may take a list of the defilements of the mind, to use the Buddhist phrase, the defilements of the mind, and say, this is what we've got to get rid of. But you see, I am defining all those qualities, all those defilements. And my definitions bear the stamp of my ignorance and my illusions and delusions. And this is where the essential aspect of mindfulness comes in, which is the keeping of the open mind. Is it so? Is it not so? Let me observe. And you see, with that spirit, one's own conditioning, which is like a hard crust, begins to dissolve away. And you see, bit by bit, more and more truly. We think we know what love means, what kindness means, what truthfulness means. We think we know that. But keep the mind open and see what happens. We will discover wonderful meanings emerge. And a little later we will say, good heavens, I thought love meant this. But no, it means this. Now I've got the truth. Don't you sit down. Go on. There is something beyond, something more. I'm using the Buddha's phrase. He himself talks like this when describing how he trains a monk, trains a bhikkhu. He says, now, don't you sit down and say that it's finished. There's a next step. Go on. Go on. You see? And so, one gradually opens out. So, what mindfulness is in operation in the immediate moment clarifies the immediate moment, and if done with the understanding that this is not the perfect mindfulness, it itself becomes greater, profounder mindfulness. It is not as if the mindfulness we have is already the perfect tool. It isn't. It's a very imperfect tool. You want the proof of this statement? Because if it were the perfect tool, there is no problem. It is being exercised constantly. And there we are. See, I'm trying to help ourselves to understand in depth the nature of the religious life. And the nature of the activity of our whole psyche and body in the process of transforming ourselves from the worldly state into the religious state. These are things which are not usually touched upon in most sort of, you know, schools of wisdom or courses of spiritual development or transcendental meditations or whatnot. We are a little bit like Hanuman. Hanuman was the great monkey, the great god, monkey god, who plays a very important part in the Ramayana, the Hindu epic of good King Rama and his wife, the good Queen Sita, who was abducted by the bad king of Lanka, Ravana. Now Hanuman, the monkey, assists Rama and his armies. Now Hanuman, there's a story about him, how he got his cleft chin. When he was a very small boy, this monkey, when he was a very small boy, looking at the sun, thought, oh, what a marvelous apple. And he made an enormous jump to get it. Well, he jumped very, very high, you see. He was in northern India then. And he didn't quite get there. And then, of course, the inevitable return to earth took place. And by the time he got to the earth at very high speed, he bumped his chin on Cape Comorin. And that is how he got the cleft in his chin. So we are a bit like that. We get enthused. Oh, the religious life, this is good. Fine. Also, I will get rid of all my troubles, my problems, and so forth. And I shall find happiness. So I make the jump to transcendence straight away. Forgetting that the sudden enlightenment, the sudden realization of perfection, is really the event, the final event, after you have reached that critical point, which is the culmination of all that you have done and realized through time and perseverance, till you got there, and then that final something took place, and lo and behold, the world was full of light. We forget all that. So now, bring this to bear. I mean, you have to do this for yourselves. Think upon this, meditate upon it yourselves. Bring this to bear upon understanding the nature of mindfulness. And you will find that thus understanding the nature of mindfulness, these deeper powers of the mind will emerge. And they will play a tremendous part, active, energetic part, in the transformation of our own psychical energy, which previously displayed so many ill shapes, ill modes of expression, what we call the vices and so forth and so forth. This way, you cease to do evil. And with the cessation of doing evil, that same psychical energy which has got transformed produces the good inevitably. Truth, reality is the good. Unfortunately, I have to use a word which belongs to a dualistic context. Its opposite dual is evil. But unless we manufacture a new vocabulary to denote the transcendent, the integration of what we call good and evil here, we have to use the preferable words to in the context of the transcendent also. You see? I don't like that. The transformation of evil is different from the absence of evil. It's different. We can discuss that sometime. You have heard me repeat this almost ad nauseam. You can't put cleanness into a dirty room. You only remove the dirt, and the room is clean. As the evil gets transformed, the good is there. The conceived good is always the constricted good. Because the good, which is the infinite reality, is being put into a particular form. Whatsoever is put into a particular form undergoes constriction. And that constriction will always produce a conflict somewhere, somehow. So the conceived good is not the absolute good. Understand this, you will understand why Krishnamurti particularly brushes aside all standards of judgment, all evaluations, all criteria. He's quite right. Because all our standards and evaluations and criteria come out of our psyche as it is. And since our psyche as it is not the whole psyche, the perfected psyche, it is Psyche, the daughter of a mortal king and queen. It is not Psyche who is in timeless conjugation with Eros after going through the whole cycle of sorrow and trouble and finally realizing union with Eros. But Eros is an immortal god. And so a mortal can never have timeless conjugation with the immortal. The psyche gets immortal. Meaning that the manner in which your mind, my mind, function is now godlike in quality, utterly pure, utterly cleansed. And therefore, it does not obstruct that mode of awareness which is the completely unworldly mode. It is the religious mode of awareness.